The Rosenbeck Museum and Library presents Sherlock Mondays, hosted by Edward G. Pettit.
Welcome to Sherlock Mondays. I am Edward G. Pettit of the Rosenbeck Museum and Library in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and we're going on a biblioventure through the stories of Sherlock Holmes. This is episode 19, The Adventure of the Yellow Face. And joining me as co-host is Monica Schmidt. Hi, Monica.
Hey, Ed. How are you doing tonight?
I am good. Thank you for reshuffling. If people were coming into this episode, because last week I announced that Mary Alcaro would be co-host, Mary had a traveling issue, and Monica jumped in. Thank you so much, Monica.
Oh, happy to do it. We're all part of the same team, and I actually had the day off because I was traveling, so it all worked out.
Good, good. All righty. Well, what Monica is joining me for today, everyone, is on Sherlock Mondays. We deduce, decipher, dissect Arthur Conan Doyle's stories about the world's first consulting detective, Sherlock Holmes, and his able assistant, Dr. John Watson, in a kind of conversational annotation. I'd like to remind you, if you're watching live right now, to, if you'd like to, please like and subscribe to these videos on our channel, and also to have fun in the live chat. If you're watching the recording, please like and subscribe as well. Sherlock Mondays is also an audio podcast, so if you're listening to just the audio, thank you so much for listening. And I would also ask everyone to please consider making a donation to the Rosenbeck. If you've already donated or joined as a member, I really appreciate it. That's how we get to do this show for free, because of your support for the Rosenbeck. So if you've not already donated or could make a further donation, or if you or to become a member, I invite you to do so. I'll tell you a little more about that at the break as well. And before we start tonight, let's figure out what I'm drinking. I don't know if you're drinking it yet. You're still waiting on your mixologist, maybe?
I'm still waiting on my mixologist. My superior Ginger is in the other room, who will be mixing me a beverage. But I'm just drinking sparkling water in the meantime.
Every episode features a Sherlock tale designed by our good friend and co-host, Mary Alcaro. You can find the recipes in the YouTube description for the episode. But if you register for Sherlock Mondays at rosenbeck.org, I also send out the recipe via email the week before every show. And tonight, it's the Norbury Spagliato, which is usually the Negroni Spagliato, but
it's Norbury.
Mary came up with it because the spagliato, the word itself in Italian, means mistake, and so it is because it's a Negroni, but the mistake in the Negroni is it's Prosecco instead of gin.
Mm.
And as Sherlock makes he's 100% wrong about the case in this, you know, in this story. So
he is human after all.
Yes.
Despite, and I'll just say, contrary to the rumors, he is human after all and capable of making mistakes. And Norbury, actually a dear friend of mine happens to, a bunch of us have Sherlock Holmes tattoos, and a dear friend of mine has Norbury tattooed on them as a reminder. So, you know, it's
humble, you know?
Exactly. It's all about staying humble.
Yep. Well, you were also on a traveling day today, you just mentioned. So because you're coming in from other Sherlockian meetings.
I did this weekend I did a jaunt to Minneapolis by way of Madison, Wisconsin, to go visit my parents briefly. I saw Jeffrey Hatcher, who is a Sherlockian. He's a member of the Baker Street Irregulars. His rendition or his adaptation of Dial M for Murder was playing at the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis. And so I had an opportunity to see that. And then the Minneapolis Sherlock Holmes Society, the Norwegian Explorers, also had an event last evening as well. And so I decided to attend that. But I look forward to later this year. There's going to be a much bigger event in Minneapolis, and I'm very, very excited about that. But Bill, thank you. I have Superior Ginger, who is actually popping the Prosecco. Bill, thank you.
Filling that up. Ah, lovely.
Oh, Bill, thank you.
Cheers.
All right. Cheers, baby.
Cheers.
I have Best Ginger. Cheers.
Yes, you do.
Oh, he is. Bill is fantastic. But now what I was saying about Minnesota is that historically, the Norwegian explorers of Minnesota, which were established in 1948, historically, pre-COVID, they would do a conference every 3 years in conjunction with the University of Minnesota and the Friends of the Sherlock Holmes Collection at the University of Minnesota.
University of Minnesota has an amazing Sherlock Holmes collection.
It's the world's largest Sherlock Holmes archive. And so it's like this repository of awesome all things Sherlockiana. And it's wonderful.
For those who don't know, why is this science society called the Norwegian Explorers?
Well, it's a little spoilery for the empty house.
You're right, it is. Because we'll actually deal with this at the end of the season. No, you're 100%. Yes. We're not going to say why.
It's the connection.
But
you'll find out in the empty house why it's called the Norwegian Explorers.
Yes, thank
you. But they are a wonderful Sherlockian society, and they've always been like really fabulous and really supportive, and very academically forward. And their conference is top class. My first Sherlockian event ever was the 2010 conference. I have to admit, I've attended many Sherlockian events, many conferences that are done in the academic style, some that are done more like in a science fiction con style, but for the academic style, and there's been really great events, but nobody quite does a Sherlockian conference quite like the Minnesotans.
Nice.
Yeah, it's absolutely wonderful, and they do long form presentations. So usually at conferences, it's like a 20-minute presentation max. In Minnesota, they're 40 to 45 minutes plus, and it's 2.5 days worth of top class presentations from we'll just say presenters from all across the United States. Sometimes we do have people from other countries who present, but I know several people, including my friend Mitch from Japan, who is going to be flying in specifically for this conference. So, wow. Yeah, it's amazing, way to spend an extended weekend in Minneapolis.
It's July 26th to the 28th. We put the link to it in the chat, in the live chat. We'll also share that information on our Sherlock Mondays Facebook page, too. I would love to go. I'm hoping I could do it this year. I mean, I want to come to everything now. It's just a matter of what I can manage in my big literary life. So,
which makes sense. But the big joke for me is like, okay, you now felt the tug at your heart. The tug is the drug.
Yeah.
You have experienced BSI weekend, and you experienced what that's like, and now you want to do the deep dive and immerse yourself in it. And it's addictive. Hence my ridiculous travel schedule.
You go to everything.
I darn well try. I can't quite make everything, but I have an exceedingly fabulous and supportive spouse who is extraordinarily patient with me. But on occasion, I do have to be at home and spend some quality time with Bill. Although he is coming with me to the Minnesota conference, so I'm kind of happily combining, time with my husband and Sherlocking this time around.
Good. All righty. Well, we should get on with our story. Well, although we'll get through this tonight. This isn't going to be a marathon show. Yellowface is
it's short and condensed.
Yeah. We have shared a PDF of a facsimile of The Adventure of the Yellow Face as it was originally published in the February 1893 issue of the Strand magazine. You can download that on the Rosenbeck's Sherlock Mondays page. Yellow Face was published, and I was noticing in the past stories how many other publications they have, mm-hmm. because Doyle was publishing in all in lots of different places, because he had a free mm-hmm. hand to negotiate other, you know, kind of publications outside mm-hmm. of the Strand, especially in the U.S. And I noticed The Yellow Face was only published in both the Strand magazines, mm-hmm. the U.K. and the U.S.,
okay,
Harper's Magazine in the U.S., and then the Glasgow Weekly.
So, interesting.
And then at first I thought, maybe the content, maybe like the, you know, the woman having a child with a black man and the acceptance of that, like maybe that was too much for the U.S. newspapers.
But that's almost what I was thinking.
But it's not the case. What happened was all those first story, those first 12 adventures, he was selling the rights to mm-hmm. lots of U.S. newspapers to do them. Some of them even did mm-hmm. them really.
Yeah.
And then with this new series, which later comes to be the memoirs, but it's still, mm-hmm. they're all listed as adventures, with Silver Blaze, it's only in a couple newspapers.
And exclusivity.
Other newspapers. Yeah. And then Cardboard Box is the Bow Strands, Harper's, Glasgow Weekly. And that's what happens with these stories now. It mm-hmm. seems that either Doyle or his agent has changed the distribution rights in that. And that makes sense for an author who is now only a professional writer. He is mm-hmm. he's no longer a doctor. He needs to make all of his income. Well, I mean, not all of his income. He involves in business investments too. But, you know, he's trying to make the most money from his work. Mm-hmm. It's a few regular magazine or weekly publications, then the book form. And if he continues to do all these, you know, gazillion newspaper publications, they tend to get reprinted at will as well. So it's really hard to prevent other newspapers from then picking them up once they're out there like that.
Yeah.
So it's
hard to make a profit when you know there's publication and piracy that's rampant. So
he's limiting his audience now. Mm-hmm. So it can, you know, I guess get the greatest impact. And then, you know, only the people that get these few, there's a couple stories that wind up also in the Baltimore Weekly. I guess he chose that too. And I'll have something, and I'll share for the Harper's Magazine, which was Harper's Weekly, which mm-hmm. I'll share the illustration from that as well tonight when we also look at the Strand illustrations. So let us begin. It is adventure number 15. And we get this little opening of Watson again talking about the kinds of stories that he publishes. And this is something that happens, I don't know how many stories this features in now. I've been keeping track of this kind of stuff. More than half of the stories, or about half of the stories now, he mentions, why am I publishing this story? What's, you know, going on in our life and how this, you know, how this story comes to be. Mm-hmm. Why am I sharing it with you? And for this time, it's in publishing these short sketches based upon the numerous cases in which my companion's singular gifts had made me the listener to, and eventually the actor in some strange drama, it is only natural that I should dwell rather upon successes than upon his failures. Well, of course, makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll just say failures don't necessarily sell stories anyway.
But Watson said it's not so much the sake of Sherlock's reputation. It's just the fact that if he didn't succeed in solving the case, nobody else did either. And so that's kind of a dead-end story to tell, to share with people. But two stories, Sherlock failed, but they have an ending and they're interesting enough that he can share them. This one, and then he says a story called
The Musgrave Ritual, I'll be doing in three.
So you have Musgrave Ritual. Sorry.
What do you have?
So here's a difference in texts, right?
Yeah.
It's good. I'm glad we could bring this up.
Oh, this is great.
It's the American. Is it the Harper, I think it's the American that they say it's the Musgrave Ritual and the and this the Yellow Face. For the British version, it's the Second Stain. And that is the original text. He did originally write the Second Stain.
Okay.
And is the other one, which he hasn't written yet, which he's not going to write for 10 years. It's like he doesn't even have an idea that this story is. This is one of those cases where he's mentioning an unpublished case that he won't do. But in this case, he does wind up writing it.
Yeah.
I'm pulling up.
Fascinating. I didn't realize because I have to admit, I looked at the text. I looked at some text online as well, and then I also listened to the Stephen Fry read audiobooks, just because I was doing so much driving this weekend. It's a little easier sometimes to do the audiobooks, and all of them were consistently the Musgrave Ritual.
Yeah.
And so, that's fascinating to me.
American edition, according to Les Klinger in his
annotated, of course,
American
Les.
Editions refer to the Musgrave Ritual, but the original strand had Second Stain, not capitalized as if it was like the name of a case kind of thing. It was just, he just the came up with this weird term, but but it was changed to the American edition. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether or not that was at a request from Doyle to do that or not, but yeah. So in my case, it's the Second Stain, which isn't going to be written for 10 years.
Yeah, although I do have to admit, with the Second Stain, and this is maybe a preview of coming attractions down the road, but the Granada version of that, so the Jeremy Brett version of the Second Stain, I think is actually one of the most accurate adaptations of a Sherlock Holmes story that has ever been put to television or film. And so I absolutely adore not only that story, but that version of the televised version of that story.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a sucker for something that's a straightforward adaptation, because in Sherlockiana, we so rarely get that.
We have in this story and a few others, we have some other changes like this, just some little textual changes. There's a textual change late in the story that at the very end of the story that's really interesting. And I wonder what you're going to have. So I'm not going to bring it up till then.
Oh, no. Well, we'll compare notes down the road. So,
So Watson's going to publish this story, even though Holmes failed. And not only did Holmes fail, he completely fails.
Yeah, he belly flopped level failed.
And then we get a little bit of Watson describing, Holmes's, personality has kept what he does. And he doesn't like no exercise just for exercise's sake.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm thinking, yeah, that's my philosophy, right? But then I realize I don't have any reason to exercise anyway, so that's not good. Holmes at least will come up with things where he can actually exercise. I don't even come up with that. And he's one of the finest boxers of his weight that Watson has ever seen, which I'm pretty sure I'm not, a great boxer, especially at my big weight now. I'm literally a heavyweight, so I'd be turned. I'd get killed.
Holmes was tall, thin, and tortured, if you will. He would have survived well in what, 80s heroin chic, I guess.
Yeah. Well, he goes on to say that that not only physical activity must serve a purpose, but he doesn't know how Holmes gets enough exercise. He chucks it up to his spare diet and austere habits.
Yep.
Except for the cocaine.
Well, except for the cocaine, which is
entirely justified
whatsoever.
He entirely justifies it, right?
Oh, totally. Which is really funny, considering in Sign of Four, he was so very against it. Like he felt it was a huge weakness, and so this is where we get either you accept that Watson is a waffling, semi-unreliable narrator, or you go with the school of Watson never lies. And so either his medical opinion has waffled or changed, or there's chronology issues that come with this. Or, there's any number of reasons why, or to explain why Watson would have waffled on this one a little bit. But, I think to be fair, though, I think it's human nature when you see somebody who's got a we'll just say maybe a problem with substance use, to be like, yeah, maybe it's not that bad. Maybe they can handle it. You know, so I can see Watson as a human trying to rationalize and justify Holmes's cocaine use.
Well, I mean, it's also the time period. It's also the, you know, the time the story's written. They don't think it's that. Like, it's bad for you, but it doesn't have the same, you know, stigma it does now. And Watson's attitude is he only turned to it as a protest against the monotony of existence. Like, they're fighting ennui, of course.
Well, fighting ennui and boredom. And, you know, what's really funny, drug and alcohol professional here for a moment. You know what the number one cited reason for using among my clients and most clients are is boredom.
Really?
Wow. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, that's where it starts for a lot of people is boredom. It's a way to make the brain do the fun things and be interesting and exciting and, you know, a break from the monotony of life.
And if you're a fictional character, it's never really going to hurt you. So you can stop at any time when you're a fictional character. In real life, it's, of course, you know, far more dangerous.
But was he a fictional character, Ed? Really?
I have to treat him as one because I have to talk about Doyle. So.
For me, Doyle is just the literary agent.
I love the game, but you know, I have to give Doyle his credit for for this show and show how these stories. That's why chronology doesn't matter for me because it's for me the important chronology is the order Doyle has written his stories and how things develop over that run.
So essentially, publication order. Yeah. Whereas for me as a clinician analyzing Holmes, it's the internal chronology or lack thereof and the internal consistency or lack thereof that's important. And so, you know, it's fun to play the game, you know, but I also understand.
I think you can learn a lot doing
that
it.
Is required. Yeah. Yeah. The mind warp that's required, but. All right. Yeah. It appears that there's a question that, had Doyle already written the Musgrave Ritual when the change was made in the text?
Yeah, he had written the first few this year already before it was published. So that might have been the publishing reason that they know that story is coming up. So they was changed. Mm-hmm. Doyle had made a late change for the American edition. But he had actually written Musgrave. He's not writing like Dickens would do. Like, you know, the story's got to come out this week, and he finishes the week before, you know, or the day before even. No, he's not doing that. He's written, you know, this batch of stories. He writes them like three or four at a time, and then he'll take a little break, and then he'll write the next little bunch, and he'll be finished, you know, a good... you know, 4 to 6 months before the last one is published, he will already have, you know, capped it off.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's early spring, we learn. And Sherlock, and this is why you're talking about the taking, you know, exercise. Sherlock has decided, sure, I'll go for a walk in the park with you, Watson, for 2 hours.
Because I have nothing better to do.
You're going to regret it. You know, you got to stick to it. If I'm not gonna take a casual walk in a park, don't do it. And he almost regrets it because when they're gone, they return. The page boy is there, not named yet, but.
But that's what I was about to say is the page boy doesn't have a name.
Yes, he's still just the page boy. Someone has been to see him. Holmes glanced reproachfully at me, at Watson. So much for afternoon walks. And someone has been there, but he was so restless and so nervous that he wound up, he paced around and complained that he wasn't there, and then he left. But he has left behind...
your favorite, his
I
pipe.
I love this. He leaves
I was going to say, this is, I'm so excited to hear you gush.
A pipe on the table. And Holmes does that Dr. Bell trick with the pipe again. He's going to deduce what he can learn about someone's pipe. It is a nice old briar with a good long stem of what the tobacconists call amber.
Ooh, amber.
And he talks about that there's not really any, most amber mouthpieces. And that would be the end of the pipe here, the mouthpiece. would be made of amber. People
as compared to like rubber that. Or
yeah, this kind of hardened rubber, this like lucite, you know, but or sometimes there would be, you know, entirely wood, you know, stem would just continue. But it's amber would happen sometimes. Holmes is right that there really weren't that many of them, but what they did know how to make are these kind of compound plastics that kind of look like amber. And whether or not people would put flies in them to make them seem like amber, I have never come across any evidence that ever happened. But I kind of look at the story as a little bit of evidence that this is probably a thing that, like, just the same reason that, you know, the cost of the pipe is 7 and 6 pence. I don't need to go research how much pipes cost then.
Yeah.
That this is where I could probably learn that. This is information that he's bringing.
That's fair. Although I wonder, just because I'm thinking about this in terms of, you know, this is sometimes where the millennial ADHD brain kind of comes in handy. Jurassic Park, the whole idea was basically about a fly caught in amber or, you know, basically stuff, you know, DNA that's preserved in amber. And so, or not a fly, sorry, a mosquito in amber. And so, you know, perhaps this is where Michael Crichton stole the idea. I mean, that as well. I mean, you know, we already know that he stole the title from Doyle.
Yeah.
So perhaps he stole this idea from this story.
Yeah, maybe. And you can even buy now, you can buy pieces of amber that have, you know, insects in them. That's the people still find those, and they're when they're found, they know whoever finds them knows that they're valuable and then can be sold. It's not the amber is valuable so much as that it's got this, you know, preserved insect from, you know, who knows how long ago inside it.
Inclusion from centuries ago or however long.
But I'm not gonna smoke a pipe with a fake fly, with a fly in the thing, like I'm not gonna do that. So that's a little weird. But the first thing that he says about the pipe is that he is evidently values highly this pipe, and then he goes through the whole thing that it originally cost 7 and 6 pence, 7 shillings 6 pence, but it's been twice mended with silver bands. And I was going to use a pipe tonight. I have a couple silver band pipes, and I did this once. I had a nice meerschaum that broke. It actually cracked. The meerschaum cracked, so I had a silver band put on it, and I love this pipe. But then the whole mouthpiece, which was a kind of like fake looking amber, it was that orangey color. It completely shattered, and I've never gotten a replacement mouthpiece for it. So I didn't have that. But this pipe is actually probably the oldest pipe that I smoke. I mean, I've smoked this pipe close to 30 years.
Okay.
None of the others have I smoked this long. And I've had to repair it. I've had to take it apart and make repairs to this, you know, piece where it all connects. And so I never had to have it banded, but I have repaired it myself because I like the way it smokes so much, and it still smokes well. So there we go. So this is my version of, and it's Briar. It's my version of Grant Monroe's pipe here. Let me share the picture of Sherlock with this, looking at this pipe. And if the sharing feature would work a little better, we're having a little difficulty here.
Who knows?
So, all right, try it again.
Yeah. Well, if it does the weird thing.
Be okay.
Yep.
Share screen, basic. Oh my Lord. There we go. All right. Working with this for a long time. I should know how to do this better. Here it is. Holding the pipe here.
Oh yes.
See, it's got like 2 bands here. I mean, if you really look
at it. Yeah, I was going to say, let's zoom in.
And Sherlock conducting a little pipe class here with Watson. He also mentions that it is, he comments on the, well, the rareness of the amber stem. I mentioned that. And then he says about pipes are so rare, or say so much about an owner. He says, pipes are occasionally of extraordinary interest. Nothing has more individuality, save perhaps watches and bootlaces. Interesting.
I can see the watch because, you know, again, it's a callback to the, to the sign of four.
We've seen that.
Bootlaces. Interesting.
What a little tease there, you know, that he could tell something about bootlaces. The other thing he talks about is, I'll stop the share here, is the Grosvenor mixture that he smokes in it. Well, first he says he's a muscular man, left-handed, excellent set of teeth, careless in his habits, no need to practice economy. Just looking at a pipe. And the Grosvenor mixture at 18 pence an ounce is kind of expensive. I guess it is. I'm not sure.
This is probably a little garden path here, but, what is the Grosvenor mixture, if you know?
We have no idea. There was actually a Grosvenor mixture made by a company called Adkins & Sons that was making that at the time. I've seen advertisements for it. In the same time period, whether or not that's what he meant or not, because you can find tobaccos called Grosvenor over time. It's not a specific thing, it seems to me, or I've never discovered it to be a specific thing. But the fact that he says, here's something about Holmes, though. He says he might get an excellent smoke for half the price. You know, I'm not going to trust Holmes's, idea of an excellent smoke, because I think they're wildly different than what other pipe smokers would do. Because we know he smokes junk. He'll smoke black shag, like really coarse stuff, smoke the leftover leavings. Like, he doesn't care about that. He's the kind of guy who will drink the worst canned coffee on the market and he'll say, it's just as good as the fancy stuff,
Well, it has, well, I mean, I can appreciate that.
Caffeine.
That's what I was about to say. For Holmes, it's about caffeine content,
nicotine.
To we'll just say self-medicate his ADHD along with the cocaine. But under the circumstances, it's not about experience. It's not about quality. It's about what the effect that it provides.
Yeah, how much nicotine can I get out of this? You know, tobacco.
And if I can get a lot of nicotine.
Which is what I think he's interested in. So, and he also, he says that the owner of the pipe lights it at a lamp or a gas, horrible. You destroy your pipe over time. So, you know, there's no way your pipe's going to survive that over time, being lit all the time at a flame like that, you know, sideways. Mm-hmm. Well, and he knows that he's, what is it, left-handed?
Yeah.
Left-handed. By the way.
Because of the right side of the jet.
By the way, he lights it. So, all righty. A lovely little rabbit hole down there between pipes and tobaccos and how to light them and all that. Sorry, everybody. I just love that.
It's educational, Ed.
It's the kind of stuff you're going to get on the show that if I'm smoking a pipe, there's no way I'm not talking about the pipe smoking in the story. So.
You know, I was actually looking forward to this discussion on the drive back from Minneapolis this afternoon. Just because I knew that I would learn something new. So this is always helpful. Things I will incorporate in a future Sherlockian paper.
There's some really good pipe, literature out there in the Sherlock world about tobacco and the pipes and everything. So
very much so.
I have a lot of it, and I think I've read almost all of it. It's good stuff. The client comes in finally. He is carrying a brown wide awake in his hand. Did you catch that one?
I did, but I have to admit I was lazy and I didn't look that up.
Wide awake is slang for a broad brimmed hat. You know, it could be like one of those Quaker hats and all. It's just a broad brimmed hat is what it is.
Okay.
Of any like all any kind of broad. And I saw in might have been in Les Klingers, but I've also seen in other places they think it might be because it doesn't have a nap. Which is like a thing about a hat that has a, it's a, But I don't think that's true. I just think that people called it wide awake because it was a big hat. So it's like
wide awake. I mean,
so
it makes sense. It's reasoned, or we'll just say well reasoned.
Not significant, but there was also, I wanted to share before that. Mm-hmm. Let's see if this share will work well, because the Harper's Magazine also has an illustration of Sherlock and Watson looking at the pipe.
Mm-hmm.
And here it is. And enlarge it and move it up, and there they are, and there's Sherlock. What the heck is this? You know, what's he wearing this derby for? And
I was about to say, big old derby.
And but look how young he looks. He looks like a baby face on him.
Well, I mean, you know, in Studying Scarlet, Holmes and Watson were in their like mid-20s, and so. You know, if depending on where this falls in the internal chronology, they're still reasonably young men.
This artist has made them very young here. Watson looks even older here with his mustache and his top hat, but Sherlock looks very young here indeed, I think.
I don't see the hairline.
No. But it's just unusual. Like, if you saw this picture, you wouldn't guess it was Holmes and Watson, because we're seeing Paget illustrations. And,
very much so.
A lot of these early illustrators, they're doing what they want to do.
I mean, they're the ones basically imagining the character. So, you know, they have free reign.
And that illustrator is, I should say, it's William H. Hyde, H-Y-D-E, just like Jekyll's alter ego. He did 21 illustrations for Harper's in this second series of stories. Okay. Harper's is now doing these stories, and there's always, you know, two or three illustrations in every story, and Hyde was doing all the illustrations for Harper's.
Okay. So,
and that's, you know, really, that's what the American, a lot of Americans were saying the American Strand edition, which had the Paget illustrations, but there's also a Sherlock reading audience out there that's seeing Hyde's illustrations for Sherlock. Mm-hmm. You know, in a sense, in their head, that's what he looks like as they're going from story to story.
Yeah.
The so Grant Munro shows up. Well, we'll find out if he's Jack or Grant later. He shows up and he just flops down in a chair, fell rather than sat down upon a chair. Holmes says, "Oh, you haven't slept for a night or two." And in his easy, genial way, I like that reminder again. This is,
yes.
He's not, you know, he's not sharp, mean, condescending to them. He's, you know, this is usually how he's talking to clients, his easy, genial way. And asks if he wishes to employ me as a consulting detective.
Yes.
And does the, it's funny here, he does the Dr. Bell trick, and when he knows his name, and he springs up, how do you know? But here.
Exactly. It's basically what it's on the, like the inner brim of the wide awake.
Which I think is a little clever little joke for Doyle, for us readers. Like, we're used to seeing him like, oh, well, of course, you know, I knew, and I could tell by this way, and he would go in this long, this explanation. Here's just like, you're wearing a name tag. So,
it feels, I mean, you know, again, it feels like Back to the Future, where the underwear, like, your name is Calvin. Exactly, your name is Calvin Klein, because it's written all over your underwear. So,
and that, you should label your underwear. You never know, you might lose it, right?
So exactly.
He tells Munro that he says, "My friend and I have listened to many strange secrets in this room, and we have had the good fortune to bring peace to many troubled souls." That, you know, idea that he's not just solving crime; he's helping people.
Exactly. It's a service for humanity that Holmes is doing, and to be fair, it is. I mean, you know, at this point in history, you know, Scotland Yard, bless them, but you know, there's, they're, we'll just say they are variable in their ability to solve crimes. You know, if people want peace or want resolution, Holmes is probably the better option.
Mm-hmm. So his problem, though, is it's his wife, and we are estranged, and I want to know why. Which is fascinating. He's literally coming for marriage advice, is what he's coming for. This is Holmes complaining before about people like coming to find their lost lead pencils. Now they're coming for marriage. Could you advise me on my marriage, please?
Asking someone as antisocial as Sherlock Holmes about human relations is
marriage counselor? Marriage counselor? No, I'm not giving him that job. So.
No, Holmes is definitely not an MFT.
So, but what he says, he gives a little history. His wife has a secret. She acknowledges that she has a secret, but she won't reveal it. And and then he gives a little history of her. She was a widow when he met her. She was but only 25. She was a Mrs. Hebron. She married in America in Atlanta. He was a lawyer. Yellow fever broke out. Husband and child died. She got 4,500 pounds money she has. Average of 7%. So, you know, she can support herself.
Mm-hmm.
But she comes to England and meets him. And then he says, we fell in love with each other and we married a few weeks afterwards.
Whirlwind romance.
It still happens, but it's unusual these days for people to meet and get married within a few weeks. Although it definitely happens. It's not the societal norm. Usually you get to know somebody, you want to make sure you know them and, you know, put some time in. But again, this is, you know, in the 19th century, we're still at a time where you don't really get to date.
Yeah.
I mean,
not the way that we know it in the conventional, like modern sense.
It's coming in. People are courting each other. Mm-hmm. You could spend time with members of the opposite sex far more than people could at the earlier part of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. But you're still kind of stating your intentions when you're seeing someone. Your intention is, you know, we'll get married. This is just a precursor to that. So,
yep.
He also mentions that she has, when they got married, she made over all her property to him against his will.
Yeah, which is unusual. I mean, you know, but it is also a pretty significant act of goodwill of, hey, I'm coming to this. I'm trusting you. I love you. I care about you. And in this particular era, women didn't have a lot of property rights. They didn't have a lot of fluidity of income. And so her transferring all of like everything that she owns essentially to him is huge. But I mean, it's also it's a huge act of love and trust.
Legally, it wasn't as bad as it used to be. There's the Married Woman's Property Act of 1870. And that allows not just single women and widows to keep their money, but now also married women can control their own money. So that is actually, it's not getting married and then all your property and is everything that belongs to your husband. Women can do that now. And then there were also frequently settlements. And this had always happened, that you would get married to somebody. If you had money, there would be a settlement in which the husband would agree by contract that a certain amount of money is set aside. He's not allowed to touch that. That is for her in case he dies or for whatever she wants to use it for. But it depends on the settlement. But this is unusual for her to say, you take it all. You have the whole thing. All you have control over everything.
Exactly.
And we can, I mean, there's no great reveal. We read the story, so we don't have to worry about saying what happens at the end of the story. But it seems to me that this is her way of, I don't know, getting over the guilt that she feels that she's not being honest with him, maybe.
I mean, I can see that, you know, from a psychological perspective. You know, I mean, to be fair, she is keeping a very big secret from, you know, from him.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I mean, we'll just say it, For us, this is not a big, I mean, it's a secret, you know, that someone has, and I'm going to go into spoiler realm here because we're not quite there yet, but that someone has a child. It's a big deal that somebody's got a child, you know, and one that they're keeping secret. An interracial child in this era was like scandalous. Massively scandalous, which, yeah. You know, I mean, you know, is kind of what, you know, you and I discussed a little bit earlier, is that, you know, I think in some ways, you know, I mean, she's, again, assuaging her guilt, but also there's that, like, well, if I give him all of this, if I give him everything of mine and keep this secret, and if this secret ever comes out, maybe this act, like this massive act of love, or act of transferring property will be enough to keep him in my good graces. Yeah. I mean, I could see that as well.
Yeah.
Bribery. But, you know.
We will get to what happens next in just a moment. I'm going to take a little slight break here.
Sure.
To adjust my video and to also let people know that take this moment to thank all of you for watching this episode. As a nonprofit organization, the Rosenbach Museum and Library depends on the generosity of friends and supporters like you to keep programs like this free and accessible to hundreds of fellow Sherlockians worldwide. I hope you will consider supporting the Rosenbach and Sherlock Mondays by donation, which you can do so at our website, or you can become a member. A membership at the Rosenbach gives you free museum admission, discounts on programs and courses, exclusive invitations to member-only events. You can learn more about how to become a member on our website. Part of our membership gives early access to programs and courses. There's lots of online things as well. And it's been lovely since BiblioVentures began a few years ago that we now have members all over the world who support the Rosenbach and do get discounts on online programs that we do. And you could as well. There are some live online, there are some online courses now. There's a course on Joyce's Ulysses, which is coming up. There's a Robert Burns poetry course coming up online, and a Virginia Woolf course coming up. Also, lots of in-person programs, too. You can go to our website and see what those things are. You can join us on our Facebook group page, Sherlock Mondays, for lots more Sherlockian info, news, links, conversation, and fun. We do an audio podcast version of this show. You can look for that, the Rosenbach Podcast, wherever you get your audio podcasts. They drop 1 week after the video ones. And that is it for tonight. You have a new drink, Monica?
I do. I have no idea. Actually, I'm going to, if I may take a moment. Bill, what am I drinking? Bill, come on in. What am I drinking? Actually, he doesn't even know.
I don't know. This is my version of the yellow face.
Mm.
So it's yellow. There's a little face.
There we go. I've got a yellow face. It's hard to see, but there's actually like little like jimmies or glitter, you know. Like,
oh, nice. Little glitter.
Face. Let me see. Good. If I can.
Oh, I can see that.
There we go.
Oh,
yeah, there we go. Now we have a face. He's so sweet. I have the best husband, I'm not gonna lie.
Someone wrote to me, I think it was Scott Monty had written and said it was a missed opportunity to use yellow chartreuse. So,
I think Bill did Galliano, but yes. Yeah, I agree that, but that's why I wore my yellow speckled band tie. Then infuse a little yellow in here.
Back to the story. Effie says, I want 100 pounds. He's like, okay. She's like, you won't tell me why. She says, someday, perhaps, but not just at present, Jack.
Interesting.
Wow, is his name Jack? Is this just, she's already said it too. Is this just a mistake of you know, Doyle? Or he just forgot that he called him Grant Monroe, and now he's just calling him Jack. There's no real
going on. And Jack is used frequently in this story,
too. Through the rest of it, she calls him Jack.
Exactly. But I mean, you know, it's also, it could potentially be a nickname. I mean, and I'm going to, at least in my, we'll just say in my imagination, in my head canon, as the kids would say, you know, I'm going to go with Jack is the nickname for Grant. Bill's name is William. He goes by Bill. If you call him William, you get the death stare. So
perhaps Grant and Jack are not related.
Yeah, but I mean, how many people do you know that have nicknames that like have nothing to do with their name? I mean, my friend Rusty, actually Steve, our friend Steve Mason, yeah. His son Rusty, his real name is Charles.
Yeah, it could be. There's some people called Bud. Time. You know, people have those nicknames kind of thing, and his just name could be Jack. Although it is odd,
yeah,
that her first husband's name was John.
Exactly, John Jack. Which,
so
yes,
maybe she just said, "Hey, I'll marry you, but I'm just gonna say keep the Jack going because it's too hard to remember."
Wow, I'm just gonna say you under. Or we'll just say wow. I can. I'm actually kind of speechless there.
The first time in bed, she called him Jack. He was like, "What?" And she's like, "Oh, that's because
that's what I'm calling you,
Grant.
You were Jack.
You didn't know it was a nickname for Grant. I knew somebody named Grant once, and I called him Jack." Yeah, she's lying, getting by there. All right. Well.
Oh my God.
She wants 100 pounds, and he says, "Okay, I'll give it to you." But he also says, to Holmes, it was the first time that there had ever been a secret, any secret between us. Yes,
exactly. No secrets ever.
So, well, not yet. I mean, they're young. So,
yes. Just married. Or at least that he's aware of. So yeah.
He also tells Holmes now there's a cottage. Not far yes. from our house. And this is where the story then starts to get weird because
yes.
goes by this cottage, which was uninhabited before. And now it seems like there's people living there. And he sees mm-hmm. up in the window, as I looked, I suddenly became aware that a face was watching me out of one of the upper windows.
Yep.
I don't know what there was about that face, Mr. Holmes, but it seemed to send a chill right down my back. I was some little way off so that I could not make out the features, but there was something unnatural and inhuman about the face. The color was what impressed me most. It was a livid, dead yellow and with something set and rigid about it, which was shockingly unnatural.
Man, that's a heck of a description there.
I love the setup because now it seems like it's going to be you're a first time reader of this story, you know, especially when it comes out in 1893, you're thinking, ooh, it's going to be some weird gothic. It could even be supernatural. Now, you know, that's totally. Not usually what you get in these stories, but yeah. There's other supernatural stories being published in the Strand magazine. Maybe mm-hmm. this is going to turn out to be one. We don't know.
Yeah, in this case, I mean, so far, at least with, you know, what we've read so far in the Sherlockian canon, there hasn't been a whole heck of a lot of supernatural influence.
No.
But that doesn't come until
there's really. There's always hints at it, you know? Like,
yeah, there's hints every now and again. But like, I think Hound is, I think, the introduction of kind of like the potential supernatural. But that said, you know,
it's
you're
certainly
right.
weird.
There's definitely weirdness going on. There's definitely, you know, if we're looking at the Strand or like the different types of stories that the Strand is publishing, then yes, you know, there's definitely like the option for supernatural. But maybe the readers are thinking at this point that Doyle is doing that. But no.
Yeah.
They won't find out till the conclusion of the story. But, you know, there's the hints there.
So they, so he sees this face. He goes up to the cottage. Some, you know, a woman rebuffs him. Mm-hmm. She say, "A woman with a harsh, forbidding face. What may you be wanting?" And then we'll just ask you when we want ye. And then she slams the door in his face.
Yes.
So he's not going to find out anything, you know, there. And now it's when things get bad for him because he catches Effie dressing in the middle of the night and going out. And then when she comes back, she lies. And he knows she's lying.
And he knows she's lying. You know, that's never a good look for a spouse, by the way. You know, I will just say, therapist hint, don't lie to your spouse, especially when they catch you in a lie. Don't double down and continue in the lie. Just own up to this stuff. It's so much better later.
I find this interesting, too. When she comes back in, he says she was deadly pale and breathing fast. This is before she leaves?
Yeah.
This is before she leaves. She's deadly pale and breathing fast, you know, glancing at him. And it's almost like it's like a doubling, right? It's her, mm-hmm. her facial expression, that paleness really disturbs yep. him, just like this yellow face that he saw in the window has disturbed him. Mm-hmm. And so yeah. in a way, I think psychologically, he's already connected these two things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even though he knows they're not connected yet, but he will.
Well, yeah, she doesn't know that they're connected, yeah. but he knows internally. He can feel it.
But she lies to him, and then she, again, he goes to the city, he comes back, and then he finds her coming out of the cottage. And then she says, you know, to trust him. Mm-hmm. She says, I swear that I will tell you everything someday, but nothing but misery can come of it if you enter the cottage. Yeah. Trust me, Jack. Maybe call him Grant. Maybe he trusts you. Trust yeah. me only this once. You will never have cause to regret it. You know that I would not have a secret from you, but you do. If it were not for your own sake. It's always hard to trust somebody.
Somebody says, I'm keeping a secret from you for your own sake.
So our whole lives are at stake on this. If you come home with me, all will be well. If you force your way into that cottage, all is over between us.
Mm.
Which sounds like she's threatening him, but she's not. What she's saying is he won't want her anymore.
Yeah, but I mean, in this moment, within the context, it very much sounds like a veiled threat. We don't realize that the secret that she's keeping is so scandalous that perhaps he may not want her anymore.
And we'll get to all the ramifications of this at the end. Well, you know,
exactly.
No use talking about it now. He's out, and then he comes back, and she's gone, and then she's coming from the house, and he knows that. And he breaks in this time. He just goes in and it's empty. The house is completely empty.
Except
for what?
Oh, a full-length photo that Grant had commissioned of his wife, what I believe several weeks earlier.
3 months ago, he says.
Exactly.
It's sitting on the mantelpiece. And that's, you know, and now.
Yeah, she does not look good here.
He says, tell me everything. And she says, I can't. I cannot, Jack. I cannot. She says, you would forgive me before that if you knew what it was. But she doesn't tell him. And now he's, you know, now he comes to Holmes and he tell me. And now he doesn't know what to do. I know. I'll ask Sherlock Holmes.
Of course.
Because
Sherlock Holmes has all of the answers.
Yeah. I love the idea of this, that Doyle's not created this character, that people will, like, oh, something really weird has happened in my life. I know, I'll ask Sherlock Holmes. Not necessarily a crime has been committed, but there's something really weird going on.
Exactly.
This guy will figure it out. So it'll happen next week's story, too. It's, you know, it's happened already. Like the Red-Headed League. It's just something really
so
weird.
Bizarre.
It's
so
always
weird.
Been the case with Sherlock that he gets people who come to him with these unusual problems, not necessarily crimes to solve. The police come to him with crimes to solve. But
most people just come with him to, like, some problems.
Yeah.
Yes.
Marriage problems.
Exactly. Marital problems.
But this one is all wrapped up in this house, and there's a yellow face, and...
Mm-hmm.
Holmes asks some questions, because now we have the Holmes questioning the client. And this will frequently happen. He says, could you swear it was a man's face at the window? He asked about why he was disagreeably impressed by it. And Poe says it was the unnatural color and had a strange rigidity about the features. Then Holmes says, have you ever seen a photograph of her first husband?
Ooh,
which must have really like stopped him short a little, like, well, why would you ask that? But he just, you know, he says no, because all the papers were destroyed because it was a fire, and he's just seen the duplicate of the death certificate. And Holmes's advice is return to Norbury and see if, like, look at the windows again. And if you think somebody's still there, send me a wire and we'll come out. And and if it's empty, I'll come out tomorrow and we'll figure out what to do. But first, just see if somebody's there.
Yeah.
And he leaves. And what does Holmes says to Watson? I'm afraid this is a bad business, Watson.
Yes, a bad business indeed.
And then Holmes says there's blackmail in it. He just thinks it's blackmail right away. It's something either, like the first husband is still alive, or it's something connected with that. But Holmes is also thrilled by the something very attractive about that livid face at the window. I would not have missed the case for worlds. You almost did, because you were out walking in the park. Don't go walking in the park anymore, Sherlock.
No walks in the park for Sherlock.
No walks in the park. For 2 hours. And he says to Watson, I shall be surprised if it does not turn out to be correct that the woman's first husband is in that cottage. And then he describes the whole case. You know, the facts as I read them are something like this. And he thinks, you know, the husband come back or some way connected to that, that whoever's there is blackmailing her over the husband. And I love Watson's reaction. Holmes says, what do you think of my theory?
It is all surmise. it's just valid.
This is 100% true. And
100% true.
Holmes has to defend it, but at least it covers all the facts.
Mm.
And when I have more facts, we'll change it. And that is his policy. That's what he does.
Well, and to be fair to Holmes, that is actually a very valid, kind of approach to this is, you know, let's develop a theory. Yep. And then as new facts come in, adjust that theory to suit the facts versus interpreting the facts to suit the theory.
But he does have another, what's the other line though? It's about be careful about doing that kind of thing. He doesn't, he must have, you know, facts before you can. And he has some facts. He has some facts from Norbury or from Monroe that he is putting this together with. Mm-hmm. So, and like in Silver Blaze, he thinks he has it figured out when he reads about it in the newspaper. And then when it doesn't come true, he realizes I have to go on the scene to see what's going on. And that is what happens here. Like he needs to go to the place to find out what the secret of the cottage is. They do that. Monroe sends for them. They go down to the house there, and Monroe just wants to just go in. And Holmes says, you're quite determined to do this in spite of your wife's warning that it is better you should not solve the mystery. And he is determined. So Holmes says, well, any truth is better than indefinite doubt.
Yep.
Of course, legally, we are putting ourselves hopelessly in the wrong, but I think it is worth it. So Holmes is never concerned with the law. So it's justice he is concerned with. And
that's an ongoing theme here with Sherlock.
So they see, they look up at the house. They see a dark blur moving across the blind. There is that creature. Creature, Monroe says. Now we're going to get into the language that goes on here when they finally reveal he goes in. The wife tries to stop him. The servant tries to stop him. The woman there tries to stop him, and he bursts in and is there's a little girl And as she whisked round to us, I gave a cry of surprise and horror. The face which she turned towards us was of the strangest livid tint, and the features were absolutely devoid of any expression. Holmes, with a laugh, passed his hand behind the child's ear. A mask peeled off from her countenance, and it's a little black girl looking at them. But the language that he used, the little coal black negress and all her white teeth flashing, there's some problems with this language there that we'll talk about. But there's the bigger question here, though, first.
Yeah.
Maybe I shouldn't. Maybe this. But the first thing I have written down is, how do we react to a story that presents a child as this kind of monstrous, strange creature?
Yeah.
But then is revealed to be innocent.
Yeah.
I mean, my question is that demeaning portrayal by those who were, you know, I mean, they're ignorant of her identity, but it's still a demeaning portrayal of someone.
Yeah.
Does that matter that they were ignorant? Does it matter how this is portrayed? What does this reveal about them, Doyle, anyone? Alone. I mean, we'll deal with the racial issues in a second, but.
Well, I mean, I think in some ways, I mean, and a modern interpretation, or at least, for me, coming from a, we'll just say a more therapeutic kind of interpretation, is that perhaps Doyle was coming from a place of privilege, but also, a place of maybe attempting, maybe not maybe fumbling, but attempting kind of like a semi-anti-racist kind of commentary here of, oftentimes the, people of other racial backgrounds were viewed as the other, as less than, as creatures, as savages in other ways. And this is the humanizing of that.
Yeah.
And so I can see, in this particular moment in history, from Doyle's perspective, even though it's cringy to us in 2023/2024, in the modern era, it's cringy as heck. But I can see how this in this particular era actually would have been kind of progressive.
It's,
humanizing.
Yeah. I just think there are two different things going on. One is that there's some strange creature going on here that we then understand is okay to accept. Why do you have to take that route? But that's the way Doyle is presenting the story, to make it a mystery. Mm-hmm. But, and of course, when they see the child, this isn't a child. This is a black child. And that's the point. The focus,
that's the big difference,
is on the skin color, and even that, teeth flashing, that very racist, blackface kind of image.
Yeah.
That's the first thing gone to here for the description. Now, of course, I've also read some deeply racist descriptions from this time period, and this is just about the tamest thing out there. This is like, and clearly what will happen then is Doyle's trying to turn the tables on this, which is really nice.
Yeah.
But he does it in a,
Well, he does it in what we would consider to be a very sketchy and cringy way.
Yeah, but for us, it's a clumsy thing. But for him, it doesn't. I think his readers wouldn't necessarily see this as clumsy, and it winds up being shocking, especially for his audience. When Effie then comes into the room with a proud, set face, and she says, she shows him the picture, that she's had hidden in a locket of her first husband, strikingly handsome, intelligent, but bearing the unmistakable signs upon his features of an African descent. Of course, the "but," is, doesn't work well here. But
that would be a yes and, as a therapist would say, versus a yes but.
And that, but then when she goes, it's John Hebron of Atlanta, a nobler man, never walked the earth. Mm-hmm. I cut myself off from my race in order to wed him, but never once while he lived did I for one instance regret it.
Yeah.
She
is taking, again, a place of privilege, but at the exact same time, a woman in this era having an interracial marriage is massively scandalous, which basically means is that neither she nor John would have been accepted in the black community, let alone the white community. And so basically they were a couple out of place and out of time. And especially in the South.
Well, it's a mistake Doyle makes, and he tries to say they were from Atlanta, and no way is he a successful lawyer married to a white woman in Atlanta. He literally would have been killed.
I mean, that's what I'm saying is that it's post Civil War South, but still, if Baltimore is far enough south where maybe that could have happened, but. Yeah.
Effie then says she loves her daughter, whether she's dark or fair. And then she says why they were separated, that her health wasn't good when she left America, so she couldn't bring her. But I'm thinking, like, well, why'd you leave to begin? Like, I don't understand. Like, she doesn't explain this, but it seems sketchy that I left my kid, you know, because she wasn't ill. Well, why did you leave at all? But, and then she falls in love, and then she makes a mistake, and she recognizes, like, I made a mistake. I should have told you. I was terrified to tell you. She does the whole, you know, that a mother can't really abandon her child, right? Yeah. Like, it's like a real mother would never abandon. She would always accept her, seems to be what's going on here.
I can kind of see this. I've worked with some clients that have emigrated from other countries that have left family behind, you know, and so that whole concept of basically like leaving family, sometimes children, sometimes a spouse and children behind in their country of origin, in order to come to a new place. I mean, obviously, like I'm speaking as a therapist in Iowa for crying out loud, but I mean, you know, people will come to Iowa, you know, to basically like and come to America, you know, in order to make their way and send money back, you know, to wherever their country of origin is. We're just accustomed to people coming to America to do that, not fleeing America and going to England to do that.
And she has enough money to already support herself. So it's unusual. Like the whole thing is unusual.
I mean, she may have money to support herself, but in this era, you know, it is still very scandalous to be a spinster or a widow. Yeah. You know, they are often looked down upon by society. You know, obviously very wrongly looked down upon, but they are looked down upon. And so, you know, I can see from a sociological perspective, you know, why Effie would want, you know, to try to find a partner, a spouse, you know, somebody to take care of her, and then hopefully eventually somehow, well, leverage or bring in the kiddo. But if not bringing in the kiddo overtly, then covertly taking care of the kiddo because of that stability.
Yeah. And Doyle just doesn't give us this backstory. Doyle doesn't explain the situation. He doesn't have his character do it. All we could do is just come up with conjecture why someone would want to leave. It was everything was so horrible. Maybe she just wanted a break, and she felt like if I don't take a break right now, I'm going to lose my mind. You know, like who knows? Yeah. And figure I'll leave my kid, but I'll come back. And then everything, you know, happens. But
Also, if she's from Atlanta and she was married to, in this era, married to a black man, I can certainly imagine, you know, I'll just say kind of like the scandal that followed her everywhere she went, you know, that, you know, because she was part of this, she has no support network.
Yeah.
And so, I realize you're right. It is total conjecture, but it's like I can also see reasonable arguments for why she would try to find a new life.
Well, now she's finally come clean. Well, she hasn't come clean. She's been discovered. But she doesn't lie about it anymore. She says and she's proud, and she's like, "This is my child. That's it." And she says, "Tonight at last, you know all, and I ask you, what is to become of us, my child and me?" And then what does your text say?
Okay. So yes.
Mind that she clasped her hands and waited for an answer, and then.
And my child and me, she clapped her hands and waited for an answer. It was a long 10 minutes before Grant Monroe.
Can you imagine waiting for 10 minutes? It's not that way in the Strand text, in the UK Strand text.
Do tell.
2 minutes.
Two.
They changed it to 10. That just could be a typographical error change. Even 2 minutes would be like, would seem like forever.
But 10 minutes would be like a bloody eternity.
That would be the worst thing in the world. 10 minutes waiting for an answer.
As a therapist who doesn't sit well with silence, you know, 10 minutes of silence in a therapy session is like pure bloody torture to me. So, and that's like when
waiting for the most important answer and waiting for the most important answer of her life, right?
Like, so it's like I can see like poor Effie like aging 100 years in those 10 minutes. Poor lady.
But it was 2 in the original text. So there you go.
Oh, well,
so not so
thank
bad.
Thank you, Doyle, for giving Grant a little bit of,
Well, and now Grant Monroe saves the story with his reaction. We can talk it over more. He picks her up right away. He picks the child up, kisses her, and then goes to his wife and says, "We can talk it over comfortably at home. I am not a very good man, Effie, but I think that I am a better one than you have given me credit for being." That it's at least he has that reaction. Now, that also still makes this another white savior story, right? Another story where I, will accept black people and I'm helping them. And like that whole white savior thing that happens so frequently in, in literature and movies, by white people, it's psychologically, it's the way of dealing with the situation, but, it's still, there's no agency on anybody other than the white people in this story.
I can appreciate that just because, again, within the context of the era and, where this was set, the greatest agency to a degree was from, the individuals at the top of the socioeconomical heap, also known as white men.
Yeah. Those in power say, okay, I'm all right with it. Then. Yeah. Okay. But,
And that's what this is really all about it's basically he's in a position of power. She has given him all the power. So she's hoping on his better nature. And so, to a degree, Effie actually did set this up because. She was banking in some ways on his better nature, and fortunately he did not disappoint. But there is this white savior thing, and so it kind of is like racist from that perspective, but it is era contextually appropriate because in this particular era, from a white author, are we really going to get a sense of agency from, the individual or from the African, the African-American perspective? No. So this is as close as we get to anti-racist within the context of this era. But by today's standards, it's like cringy as heck.
It is. And you still have to recognize what's going on. Someone in our chat here, Jack, just made the comment, and this kind of goes on with my final notes here. Yeah. He wrote that it occurs to me that the child is the only character that doesn't speak in the story.
Exactly.
This is a story about racial acceptance, but it's couched in terms only for the white people in the story, the white audience reading the story, not the little girl who was forced to conceal her identity and look like a monster haunting from the past, which is actually an apt metaphor for this society that Doyle's writing in and still ours, that this kind of specter of racism is haunting these characters.
Well, it's alive and well. Yeah. And also this is the era of children should be seen and not heard. And so I can appreciate the concept of, the kid has no lines. The kids are at this point in history still kind of property, And so I can appreciate from Doyle's perspective, him not including, again, any agency, any lines, any motivations, any feelings or thoughts to this kid.
I'm fascinated. I mean, I'm not saying all this as a kind of condemning thing against Doyle but it is because it is it. But I have
it's
to look at it.
Interesting for discussion.
Yeah, I have to look at it honestly and how it's presented and what's going on here, and that yes, there are characters in this story who are doing something that for them is completely magnanimous and noble, and yet
it feels
not
awful.
That.
And that's. Yeah, I mean, and that's that for me as a therapist, I often have to walk that line.
Yeah.
Just because I have a lot of clients who do things from a perspective where they think that things are often okay and they may not actually be okay.
Yeah.
And so it's basically trying to put yourself in their position and understand where they're coming from, which is one of the reasons why, I can see from the perspective of somebody in 2024 looking at this and feeling like, ooh, God, this is like gross and cringy and awful. And then I also try to put myself back into the early 1890s in London and realizing kind of like the sociological context of that era from a privileged white perspective, and try to understand and see things as much as I can through Doyle's eyes. And so it's like, I don't want to condemn, but I also don't want to excuse. And that is really, I mean, that's a very fine line to walk.
Because really, the end of the day, it is, he is being as, like, this is the height of being progressive in that he is, like, there's a woman who has had a relationship with a black man in this very male dominated power society, and he has written a story where that is accepted and okay.
Yeah.
That's a rare story.
Oh yeah. I mean,
in a middle class publication like these magazines, that's a rare story. So that's a good thing to come that happens out of this. Well, Watson and Holmes just return to London. They're like, Holmes is recognized, like, we shouldn't be here. Let's get the heck out. Like, this isn't
the rest of our story.
We're intruding. This is a private matter. We got to get the heck out of here. And and then they head back. And why don't you read that last little paragraph there, Watson, said he.
Actually, give me one second here, finding this. Okay, so what, we can talk more comfortably at home, she said. I'm not a very good man, yada, yada, yada. So Holmes and I followed them down the lane, and my friend plucked my sleeve as we came out. I think, said he, that we shall be more use in London than in Norbury. Not another word did he say until late that night, when he was turning away with his lighted candle in his bedroom, or for his bedroom. Watson, said he, if I should ever strike you that I am getting a little overconfident in my powers, or giving you less pains to a case than it deserves, kindly whisper Norbury in my ear, and I shall infinitely be obliged to you. I mean, this is basically him saying, Watson, call me out. This is, Norbury is going to be our code word for simmer down now.
Yeah. Don't get ahead of yourself. You don't know the facts yet. You think
exactly.
You know the
facts. Simmer down now.
Norbury. That's great. Norbury. So we got that tattoo. That's fine.
Exactly. And that's why my friend has that tattoo. And, it's beautiful. I mean, I have to admit, I have a Sherlockian tattoo. I love it. But, it has significant meaning, but it doesn't quite serve this particular purpose of kind of grounding me into humbleness and, reminding me to kind of, keep myself about me, which is what I love about that tattoo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, we all need our Norberries. So
exactly. We all need to be reminded that every now and again that we are human, we are fallible.
All righty. Well, Sherlockians, thank you for joining us for episode 19 of Sherlock Mondays. So much to, you know, and you know, there's a long conversation about, you know, this, the issues in this story that, you know, could still be had. So,
we leave that open to the people who want to write the essays and publish those and explore this context, or, you know, explore the context more.
This is a good one. All righty, Monica, thank you.
No, thank you.
This one, this is great. You will return for episode 22, The Musgrave Ritual.
Oh, yes, another failure.
Yes, that will be fun.
Oh, I love The Musgrave Ritual, so.
And on our next show, everyone, episode 20, Curtis Armstrong will make a quick return from his last appearance to talk about The Adventure of the Stockbroker's Clerk, which is all about a stockbroker's clerk. The clerk in the title, Paul Pycroft, stops by Baker Street to tell Holmes that there's some weird, unusual hiring practices of his new job, and Sherlock is intrigued enough to investigate. Another story that, with this like seemingly mundane title, and then something horrific will happen in the story, and real crime actually happens in this story. So that will be fun. Thanks to our chat, Mrs. Hudson, Brianna, for managing the live chat links. Thank you to the sponsor of Sherlock Mondays, Lisa Washington. We couldn't do these shows without the generous support of our patrons. You can support the Rosenbach through donation. Your support helps us create more programs like this and also care for our collections. You could also become a member. Membership gives you early access and discounts to programs and courses. You can find out more at our website, rosenbach.org. Let me remind you all again to subscribe to this YouTube channel, to like these videos. If you're listening to the podcast, leave us a review. Monica, have a great night. I'll see you soon.
See you in a couple of weeks.
Everyone else, I am Edward G. Pettit of the Rosenbach Museum and Library, where the game is a book. Bye-bye.
The Rosenbach Museum and Library thanks you for listening to Sherlock Mondays. Sponsored by Lisa Washington. Hosted by Edward G. Pettit. Music by Pleated Gazelle.